It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow, voters will narrow the field of Wisconsin Supreme Court justice candidates from 3 to 2. Coming up, we'll look at where the race stands today and what's at stake. First, if you spent time in rural areas decades ago, there are probably sounds and particular species that stand out in your memory. But there's a good chance that if you're still there, you go back to visit, you might see and hear fewer of those creatures. It turns out there are a lot of different factors that have made it harder for wildlife and farming to share land together. Our next guest says there's a lot we can do to feed people while still keeping a place for wildlife on and around farmland. John Marsliff is professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, I want to give a sound to the bird in your title there, an eastern meadowlark. Here's a listen. And that's a bird that is an emblem for a lot of the changes you've seen going on when it comes to wildlife in our agricultural areas. What is it about meadowlarks that stand out for you?
Well, a couple of things. They're pretty much obligate grassland nesters, and at least during the breeding season, that's where we see them up here in North America. Because they're so closely tied to grasslands, their populations have plummeted over the last several decades by up to 70%. By some estimates. So they're a flagship for a species that is in decline in response to the way we've treated our grassland environments.
And growing up looking at farmland all the time, the change that's happened may not stand out to us. Can you talk about, over the last couple of centuries, how we've changed our grassland ecosystems around the United States?
Sure. And first, I think your point that these changes don't stand out so strongly to us is a good one. And the meadowlark's an example of that as well. You probably, most listeners have probably still heard or seen meadowlarks in the past years, but their numbers are greatly reduced. And that's because we've done things like plowed up an awful lot of the prairie and planted it with cereal crops. And in the upper Midwest, that's mostly corn and soybean as we get a little further south as well. So the change in that perennial grass to a annual cereal grain that's harvested and disturbed each year has reduced the ability of birds to nest in that environment.
And you say, you write that even within agriculture in North America, we've had that change to that monoculture, these huge crops. In the past, was it more possible for wildlife, not just the meadowlark, but other species to survive on and around American farmland?
I would say it wasn't even more possible. It was exactly the norm there. When we had smaller farms, we had hedgerows between them. We had waterways and ponds that were left. Places that were difficult to work just weren't worked. And that was good for wildlife. They could find shelter there. There was less of a human footprint on the land.
But the big contradiction, the difficulty at the core of your book is we've got a lot of people on this planet. We keep having more and more people on the planet. How do we feed them while still leaving room for this kind of wildlife, either to live on our farmland or to live near it? How do you see that struggle shaping up in the 21st century?
I think it's going to be a struggle, and I think it's one of the grand challenges we face as a species. Unless we want to be left alone on this planet with our food, we need to do something to allow other forms of life to exist with us in these settings. And people talk about two basic strategies, the one you referred to of basically intensifying our use of the agricultural land so that we can set aside more natural lands for wildlife. And the other is to share our farmlands, not farm them so intensively, but kind of step back to the way it was in the 60s, 50s, where there was a lighter touch, more natural habitat interspersed with farmland, and a different attitude of farmers to enjoy and look for ways to coexist with the wildlife on their lands.
We're talking to John Marsliff about his new book, In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. And John, I want to make it clear In your book, you're not making farmers out to be the bad guy here. You see them as people wanting to steward their land, their soil, and their region. And you find a lot of them doing innovative things to make their farming practices more sustainable. Do you see a lot of hope coming from farmers themselves to be part of the solutions to the questions you're raising?
I absolutely do. All the farmers that I talk with, and I went to many farms here in the U.S. and Costa Rica, and in all of those cases, the farmers I met were enthusiastic about the animals and native plants on their lands, but they're faced with an economic challenge of making a living. And to do so in some settings requires them basically to work the land in a way that's not as conducive to wildlife as it once was. But they all look for ways to do it, and I found many very innovative, as you say, strategies to do so.
You point toward past success stories in dealing with challenges to the way we farm, and one is the reaction to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, where farming practices were changed in kind of one of the agricultural heartlands of the United States to resist future droughts. Does that inspire you that as big as the challenges are, there is hope today?
Well, I think whenever we face those sorts of challenges, we do tend to rise to the occasion and innovate our way out of it. And I'm hopeful that we will continue to do that. It's more difficult when we're also trying to do that and conserve species that perhaps some feel are not so necessary for our being. I don't see it that way, but that makes it a more difficult situation than just growing more food for more people. The Dust Bowl saw lots of conservation efforts put into place to save topsoil, to reduce its loss from wind, and that included planting of trees, leaving some unplowed areas, reducing tilling in general. All of those things are beneficial for the health of the land and for the wildlife that depends on it.
You look to a lot of people and institutions for solutions here. One of those groups is the consumer, people who eat food, which is, I guess, all of us. What kind of things would you invite people who eat food to think about when it comes to supporting this kind of sustainability?
Yeah, I think we can all play an important part here. And one of the first things I'd ask you to think about is, who's your farmer? Do you know them? Have you met them? Do you know how they treat their land and how they treat it with respect to harboring wildlife? I met a woman whose dad is a banana picker in Costa Rica, and I will only buy organic bananas now because of the stories from him of being doused with pesticides while he was working in the field of traditional big ag down there. So knowing the sorts of stresses that are on the farmer, how they cope with them, that can point us to buying certain types of food. And in general, one of the most important things we can do is think carefully about our choice of meat, especially. It has a huge effect on the environment, from climate change to the crops that are grown that are fed to our cattle in particular. So, again, from my standpoint, the more we can do to wean ourselves from grain-fed beef, the better we can do for the environment as well.
And then you look toward creating incentives for farmers with things like a conservation program in the U.S. Farm Bill. What kind of things would you like to see more of?
Yeah, that became very apparent as I talked with farmers that had a choice to put some of their lands into the Conservation Reserve Program or other sorts of programs like that, that allows them to fallow land or to plant it in ways that are more conducive to wildlife. They simply can't afford to do that. They make a lot less per acre than they would if they planted it in soy or corn. So rectifying that, paying for conservation and making it a fair trade to conserve versus to harvest the area is, I think, critical. And those of us who have a voice in our governing bodies should try to make that pitch strongly to them.
We're talking to ornithologist John Marsliff. He's a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. We're talking about his new book. It's called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. You can join in at 800-642-1234. if you live in a farming area, have you seen over time this decline in the number of particular kinds of birds or animals that used to be maybe more present on farmland in Wisconsin? If you're a farmer yourself, do you try to keep your farm friendly to wildlife in one way or another? If so, how? What would help you to do that? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with John Marsliff, professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. His new book is called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you be willing to pay a little more for food that you know is raised in a way that supports wildlife? How about reducing the amount of corn-fed meat that you eat? If you're a farmer, what incentives or support would help you to be able to steward your land in a way that encourages wildlife conservation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living out on a farm that was in the middle of big-time soy and corn production, and we were getting dived by my chemicals every hour of every day during the summer. It was horrible. But I bought a house in the city, and I think that people are living in some kind of despair about what they can do. I bought a house that's on a lot. It's 150 feet by 150 feet. I am digging up every speck of grass on this lot, and I am planting prairie. And I am going to invite this little oasis to be a place where wildlife and pollinators can come and be happy. And I think if everybody that could do that, because there are restrictions on it, but if everybody could do that, it's a little thing that you can do to make yourself feel better about this. You're not like just lost in this huge industrial farming complex that you can't control.
Chris, thanks for the call. John, she's doing it in her lot, but is there room for farmers to create those spaces, whether they're buffer zones or reserve areas, enough to make a difference?
Absolutely. And in at your home is also a great place to start. There's no doubt about that. Every little bit helps. But on the farm, you've got more land to work with. So again, places that are difficult to work, point rows, those little triangles that are hard to get the plow down, leaving those and letting places like that go back to nature. The areas that aren't hit by the irrigation wheels can be places where a little bit of prairie can grow. And some of the birds, the smaller birds like savannah sparrows, can get by in small patches of prairie. Meadowlarks need a little bit larger patch.
Thanks for that call, Chris, at 800-642-1234. Pete emailed us from Reedsburg. Pete says, I'm 65 and grew up in rural Richland County. In those years, birds like meadowlarks, whippoorwills, and red-headed woodpeckers were so common you barely noticed them. Today, Pete says, it's a memorable day when you see or hear even one. On the other hand, Pete says, hawks of all kinds were not very common back then. Today, they're all over the countryside, maybe because we stopped killing them indiscriminately. Shows we can make a difference if we try. What do you think of what Pete had to say, John?
Yeah, actually, it's absolutely right. Hawks have increased, but not the ones that require the grassland, like the northern harrier. That hawk has declined along with the other grassland birds. But with banning of DDT, hawk populations in general have increased greatly, and that's been a boon to that group of birds for sure. And it, as he says, it shows that some simple changes can, even though they seem difficult, imagine banning pesticides like DDT now, that change had profound effects.
Let's go back to our callers. Carlin is with us in Waukesha. Carlin, hi.
Hi. Just want to put in a plug for the monarch butterfly, because I think, the Environmental Defense Fund and everybody, I read information about it. The population has decreased by 90%, and it's the milkweed destruction. And that's where it used to live, was between the fields, the farmers' fields, and along our, along the roadways and everything. And because of herbicides and because of the way the farmers have to farm now, we don't have all that habitat anymore. So they're suffering a lot, and we need to plant more milkweed. So just putting in a plug for that, too, because
Carlin, thanks a lot for the call. I know there's this effort in Wisconsin and elsewhere, John, to get farmers and road departments and homeowners do exactly what Carlin's talking about, bring back those milkweed patches.
Yeah, and a common place was in the ditches along roads, and that's an easy target for conservation, and the verges in the roads even. That's an easy target. It's not one that's being farmed intensively right now, and a little bit of change there could, again, make a big difference.
Thanks for that call, Carlin, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Willem is on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I live in a rural community. I'm surrounded by farms, and I've lived here for 30 years, and I remember when we first moved here, I used to see a lot more meadowlarks and bobolinks and birds that are sort of nesters, grass nesters, but they've started to cut the hay so early these days. So I'm not blaming them. That's probably a necessity on their part. But this early harvesting of hay, the first cutting, is usually before the nesting birds, grass nesting birds, have a chance to fledge and leave the nest. So a lot of them are killed in that process. And then I used to also hear a lot of whippoorwills, and I haven't heard a whippoorwill, I bet you it's been 10 years. And I think that has to do with the wetland destruction, which is also, you know, wetlands being converted to different types of land use. And the other bird that I've disappeared from seeing very often are red-headed woodpeckers. So there are many birds that are disappearing. It's just that a lot of people either don't notice or, you know, I guess they just don't notice.
Well, thanks for the call. And, John, I wonder sometimes as you're talking to people, do they have that moment like, yeah, I never thought about it. I used to see these guys, these birds all the time. Now I never do.
Yes, all the time. I think, and especially a bird like the bobolink is another great example, like the meadowlark. But the bobolink is a species that kids grew up with 40, 50 years ago. And it was common. It was kind of a herald of spring. And it was looked forward to seeing that bird back. And that's been missing. And in fact, it is because of these early harvests of hay fields and some of the grasslands that are harvested for cattle feed as well. But there are some very innovative programs out there targeting these species, paying farmers to delay their harvest in California and in New England. This is working well. So farmers, again, if we incentivize the right sorts of things, they're more than happy to do this and still are able to make a living. And the bobolinks and other species are able to survive as well.
Willem, thanks for that call. We're talking to John Marsliff. His new book is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. One thing that struck me in your book, John, I think this is in Nebraska, not just a decline in species diversity, but in the number of humans in farming communities. We hear about rural decline in Wisconsin. I think you were in Nebraska where there were these once thriving, vibrant farming communities. Now they have way fewer people and way less going on thanks to the way agriculture has changed.
Yeah, I went to Ong, Nebraska, a small place that I would never have heard of except that my mother-in-law grew up there as a farm kid. And boy, it was a great place back in the day. As we drove through with her, you could see the life just drained out of her as we looked at the churches that were abandoned, all the abandoned buildings, all the favorite places and memories of her childhood basically had just been left to decay as people have moved to cities, as farms are being owned by fewer and fewer people. Big corporations don't have all the houses on the land that used to be there that supported the smaller individual farmer and the need for these smaller rural towns. So there's a dramatic shift across the middle U.S. for sure.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mary Kay is with us now in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hi, I called the DNR last year. The birds and the bees are disappearing because of pesticide applications, toxic pesticide applications. They don't want anything to do with that land. So when we have safer pesticides, which I'm sure the DNR has already issued, we're going to see them come back.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. John, just that direct impact, do we see that of pesticides on the wildlife?
I agree with that. In Nebraska, I plotted that trend out because we measure the number of acres that are treated with pesticides each year in the U.S., and that number has increased dramatically in association with decline of grassland birds. But we have also greatly reduced the amount of habitat out there. So if they're hand in hand, and I agree, safer pesticides, if such a thing exists, would be good. But there's a lot of natural ways to deal with pests. And a lot of the farmers I talked with are employing those, from having bluebirds and owls on their property to eat pests, to other sorts of plants that have pesticide benefits.
You refer to a Wisconsinite, Aldo Leopold, a few times in your book, including his charge to remake agriculture in a way that increases the, what he called, stability, integrity, and beauty of the planet. How do you see that spirit maybe being a guidepost to the future?
I think it'd be the most fantastic guidepost we could have. And I met some farmers here. I thought I was talking to Leopold a few times with the way these people work their land. They really see it as a community, not solely a commodity, which, again, is an important point that Leopold made. So I think it'd be a fabulous standard for us to try to live up to. If only more of us did, I think the world would be a much better place.
John, in our last couple minutes, it seems like it would be easy to be pessimistic. We've got this growing demand for food with more people, concern over climate change, agriculture's impact on it, how it's going to affect our farming in the future. Having gone through the experience of researching and writing this book, do you still feel hopeful?
I am hopeful. I see some solutions out there. There are some very interesting modeling exercises done to project how much we need to change to have a positive effect on the Earth's ecosystems. Certainly, we're having a huge and mostly negative effect now, but as more and more people understand the small things they can do to make a difference, I think they will, and I'm hopeful that will generate a large change in our natural world.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
John Marsliff is professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent is called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. Well, as you were listening, did you think, if you are in agriculture yourself, hey, I'm doing some of the stuff we're talking about, the sustainability practices, or I'm trying to, or I want to do more of that? We'd love to hear your story. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you're doing. Or if you're a consumer and you're thinking along these lines yourself, someone who eats food, again, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll get a preview of tomorrow's state Supreme Court primary election, including who's on the ballot, the issues in the race, and what's at stake. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the 1920s saw the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan across the country, including in Wisconsin. We'll talk with an author who's uncovered the history of a women's chapter of the Klan in Chippewa Falls. First, tomorrow is primary election day in Wisconsin. The ballots are mostly made up of local races, but there are a couple of bigger contests in some parts of the state. People in northern and western Wisconsin will be voting in Republican and Democratic primaries for the 7th Congressional District. That seat is currently vacant after Republican Sean Duffy stepped down last fall. In Milwaukee County, four candidates are vying to be the next county executive after Chris Abley announced he wouldn't be seeking re-election. There's also a primary for Milwaukee mayor. Statewide, there's only one race on the ballot, and that's for Wisconsin's Supreme Court justice. Three candidates are running for the job. They include the incumbent, Dan Kelly, Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jill Karofsky, and Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone. The top two vote-getters will advance to the general election in April. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So are we expecting a big turnout for this primary tomorrow, Sean?
No, definitely not. I mean, I think even when you get to the actual election for the state Supreme Court in April, you know, that's typically what we would refer to as low turnout affair. This is an even lower turnout affair. So you look just a couple years ago in 2018 in the February primary, turnout was in the low teens, I believe. It was actually just under 12%. in 2018. So not a lot of people are going to be deciding which two state Supreme Court candidates advance in this race.
What's at stake in the Supreme Court race?
What is at stake is that there's only, you know, seven members of the court, and they serve 10-year terms, and it's the highest court in the land in Wisconsin. And so these are very important positions, and the person that gets chosen for this position will be there for a while. So pretty much every, every controversial law that passes is going to make a stop in that court, it seems like, especially over the past decade, where every piece of, you know, Governor Walker's agenda had kind of a final stop before the state Supreme Court. And while it's not a partisan court, conservatives have, a 5-2 majority there. And so for conservatives, I say it's not a partisan court. Technically, it's for conservatives or Republicans, it's a chance to preserve that majority. For liberals and Democrats, it's a chance to start to chip away at it.
Let's take a look at the three candidates. It's Justice Dan Kelly's first Supreme Court election. He was appointed by former Governor Walker in 2016 to fill David Prosser's seat. Can you tell us about his background?
Yeah, he was in private practice before he came to the court. I mean, one case that was noteworthy that he worked on was the initial defense of Wisconsin's redistricting plan that Republicans passed back in 2011. So Justice Kelly defended the case as a private attorney back in 2012. The map was largely upheld in that case. A federal court ended up ordering the redrawing of a couple assembly districts, but it was mostly unchanged. And he's been an active member of the Federalist Society, the Conservative Law Society, that a lot of members of this court have been active in. He's friends with those members of the court, and he has been a state Supreme Court justice appointed by Governor Walker since, as you mentioned in the intro, 2016.
Then there's Marquette University law professor Ed Falone. This is his second run at the Supreme Court. He lost some years back, 2013, to Chief Justice Pat Rogensack. What do we know about Ed Falone?
He was able to build up some statewide name recognition by running for the court before. He has been a Marquette law professor for, I believe, about 25 years now. That has let him, weigh in a lot of the issues of the day. He kind of touts that he has been asked by former U.S. Senator Herb Cole to weigh in on, potential U.S. Supreme Court nominees. He has made a point of saying some of the groups that he's defended in his own cases as an attorney, among them the Solidarity Singers. So there's a situation where he's saying with the Solidarity Singers, for example, they had a dispute with the Capitol and the Department of Administration over demonstrating here. He says, I supported them because I believe in the First Amendment, although it does give him a chance to also come out and support a group that is, sided with Democrats and against Republicans.
And then Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jill Karofsky.
Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky has, endorsements from a lot of Democratic office holders. Former Democratic Governor Jim Doyle is one of the people who's been out there campaigning on her behalf, sending emails on her behalf. She is a Dane County judge. She was a prosecutor before that, and she is, as a lot of judicial candidates do, emphasized her experience as a judge as she runs for this court.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, previewing tomorrow's state Supreme Court primary. I want to give a listen to each of the candidates now. They're all on WPR's The Morning Show last week, and they're asked about when justices should recuse themselves from cases. Here's, first of all, what Judge Jill Karofsky said.
And I have done that a number of times because I have had personal relationships with attorneys who appear in front of me, and I thought I could be fair, but I was concerned about the appearance of impropriety, so I got off those cases. Now, look, what we need in Wisconsin is a very strong recusal rule. This having to do with money. And if someone gives more than a certain amount of money to a judicial candidate and then appears in front of that judicial candidate should have to get off of that case.
And then here's Ed Falone on the issue of recusal.
If someone donates a major amount to my campaign and they're a party in my case, or they're a lawyer representing a party in my case, I would absolutely recuse myself, because it doesn't matter whether I believe I could be fair and impartial in that case. What matters is the perception that the public has that our justices are for sale. And we need to fight that perception. We need to get back to where the public honestly believes we have an independent court. And that's what I'm fighting for.
And then incumbent Justice Dan Kelly on the issue of recusal.
So what I'm worried about is individuals and interests making contributions and making allegations of favoritism in a way that could potentially force a justice off a case where there is no conflict of interest, there is no reasonable worry that he wouldn't be able to be impartial in the way he applies the law. And I think it fundamentally misunderstands the nature of our elective judiciary and the responsibility and good sense of the people of Wisconsin.
And Sean, we've seen over the years this issue of when, if ever, should a Supreme Court justice recuse him or herself. This is something that does come up from time to time.
It does, and there is something, and this is an issue where if you listen to their answers carefully, there are differences between the three of them, actually, on this one. So you have Justice Kelly, who's basically saying he does not favor changing recusal standards from what they are right now. And what they are right now is basically it leaves it up to judges and justices to decide for themselves whether or not to recuse. Then you have Professor Fallone, who supported this proposal by a bunch of retired judges, who said that there should be a $10,000 kind of a bright line recusal standard. If somebody gives you $10,000 and they are a lawyer arguing before the court, you have to sit out of the case. So he favors that. Jill Karofsky says that a proposal should have been given a hearing by the court, but she has not come out and explicitly endorsed that. So she says there should be some kind of a recusal standard, but she hasn't come out exactly and said where it should be. And she said she would recuse herself in some cases involving very large donations, but she hasn't set that sort of dollar figure that Fallone has adopted.
And then, Sean, in our last few moments, two candidates will come out of tomorrow. And then the final election will also take place at the same time as the Democratic or the presidential primaries, where most of the interest is on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I mean, and in theory, you could have both liberal candidates come out tomorrow, but typically, Republicans and Democrats tend to split off into their camps. And so, you know, Justice Kelly, decent chance that he would be one of the people that emerges tomorrow. While this is a nonpartisan race, there's some thought that if there's still an active Democratic presidential primary on April 7th in Wisconsin, that could drive up turnout on that side and give them a little bit of an edge that they wouldn't have otherwise had in this race because that presidential contest generates so much attention and so much turnout.
Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with us for a look at tomorrow's primary election for state Supreme Court justice. Find out more about the candidates and the elections at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book about the history of the women's Ku Klux Klan in Chippewa Falls during the 1920s. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a group of Republican state lawmakers are proposing an amendment to the state constitution that would give constitutional rights to the unborn. We'll talk to one of the lawmakers behind the move. First, the Ku Klux Klan saw its membership rise during the 1920s, not just in the southern U.S. There were Klan groups around Wisconsin, too, including a women's chapter in Chippewa Falls. That group, called the Gray Eagles, was around from 1926 to 1931. Their history gives us some insight into the way hate groups of the time operated, and it's the subject of a new book out today. John Kinville is a teacher at Chippewa Falls High School. He's the author of The Gray Eagles of Chippewa Falls, a hidden history of a women's Ku Klux Klan in Wisconsin. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I understand you first learned about the Gray Eagles, this women's KKK chapter, when you were in college. What made you decide to tackle this book writing about their history?
So when I was a college junior, I had to start preparing for my capstone thesis at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And so when I was going to the special collections department, I came across this file of meeting minutes from the women's Ku Klux Klan of Chippewa Falls. And being from Chippewa Falls, it just it was a captivating piece of history for me. So for the last 20 years, I'm a public school teacher up at Chippewa Falls High School. And so just off and on, I've been doing the genealogy and putting things together, and then call it a semi-midlife crisis. But on my 40th birthday, I asked my wife, I said, do you mind if I write a book? And she goes, yeah, sure, go ahead. And so the rest is history.
Well, before we dig into this local chapter, let's put it on the national landscape. This is the 1920s, and there's this revival, this new version of the Klan spreading across the nation. Can you talk about what this incarnation of the Klan was like and how they reached out into new communities?
Yeah, the 1920s Klan was a lot different than the Reconstruction post-Civil War Klan. And it was basically started as a result of a movie called The Birth of a Nation. And there's a guy named William Simmons who decided he saw the movie Birth of a Nation and said, oh, you know, I have to create a fraternal organization based on this. And so he creates it in Atlanta, Georgia. And then he ends up meeting a couple of marketing specialists, and they say, hey, you got this great fraternity, we can sell this. But instead of just focusing on white pride and nativism, they decided to feed off of the xenophobia that was taking place in the 1920s, sort of this fear of the other. And even though people are having a good time in the 1920s, there's a lot of fear. Things are changing post-World War I. And so there were changes such as immigrants coming in. A lot of these immigrants were Catholic. Catholicism becomes a huge part of it. Labor unions. And during a period of prohibition, these immigrants who are Catholic coming into the country also have a taste for alcohol. And so the Klan became this this organization that was seen by conservative Protestants as quite possibly the best vehicle to unite Protestant Christians against Catholics, as well as these other groups of people who they thought were bringing a lot of detriment into the country.
And it sounds like from the story you tell, that was the selling point in a community like Chippewa Falls, as organizers were trying to bring, in this case, women on board.
Yeah, that is correct. It's, you know, when we think of the Ku Klux Klan, we often think about Jews and we think of African Americans and people of other races. But in what made the Klan such a very interesting and organization that exploded in membership was that the way they grew it was that they paid these people called Kleagles. And these Kleagles would arrive by train to the various towns. And in Wisconsin, it just happened to be in the winter of 1924, that in February of 1924, that a Kleagle arrives by train to Chippewa Falls. And his first order of business is to try to find out, okay, who in the community do people have fear about? And it just so happens in the Chippewa Falls area, it was Catholics, it was people who were drinking alcohol, and it was immigrants in particular. And there was also a labor union piece to it, but predominantly it was Catholics and people who drank alcohol.
Who were the women who formed this chapter of the KKK, the women's KKK in Chippewa Falls?
So much different than the Klan post-World War II, this era Klan is consistent of American-born, middle to upper middle class. Most of the women were homemakers, or they were the wives of farmers. They were alcohol-free, and they would have viewed themselves as God-fearing Protestant Christians who would not have swore. They would not have done things that would have been perceived as loose morals. They were very reactionary in many ways to the stereotype of the 1920s vision of a flapper, a woman who would wear pants, who would cut their hair short, who might smoke or drink. They believed that the old way of how a woman was supposed to comport herself was on its way out, and they wanted to try to preserve some of that more conservative lifestyle. And ultimately, these were women who wanted to use this opportunity to recapture, or in most cases, maybe not recapture, but they wanted to capture power and influence within the Protestant home.
John Kinville is with us. His new book is The Gray Eagles of Chippewa Falls, A Hidden History of a Women's Ku Klux Klan in Wisconsin. John, one of the fascinating parts of your research is that you went and you talked to relatives, surviving relatives of the women you write about. Not a welcome message, I imagine, for the people you talked to. What kind of reactions did you get when you told them that their mother, grandmother, whatever, was a member of the Klan in Chippewa Falls?
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that. For all your listeners out there, just imagine if you get a call from an author saying, hey, I'm writing a book on your great-grandmother. And the initial reaction is, oh, that's interesting. You know, what's it about? And truth be told, everybody has been fantastic. There was obviously some shock. There was some, I need to see proof. You know, what do you have? How do you know this? And luckily, people have been great. And a lot of them had suspected that maybe their great grandfather had been in the Ku Klux Klan potentially, or their grandfather, depending on who the descendant was. But kind of like what a lot of your viewers are thinking is, they may not have been aware that there was a women's chapter. And so the idea that their grandmother or great grandmother was in the Klan was something that was more shocking than what it would have been had it been their male relative, so to speak.
What do we know about what this women's Klan chapter actually did from day to day, week to week?
So within this file are these 58 meeting minutes that took place here in Chippewa Falls. And it kind of crosses the gamut. A lot of what the women are doing is they are fundraising to pay for their new clubhouse or religious tabernacle. The word that they used, that the Klan used, was called a clavern. And so they were trying to raise money for this new clavern, and the men were going to be responsible for 50% of the fundraising for that building, and they were going to be responsible for the other 50%. So a lot of what they do is fundraising. But in addition to that, they do a lot of interesting things. They help out a local family who was on hard economic times, and they were trying to make sure they had enough blankets for the wintertime. They're paying for flowers for a local woman's son's funeral. He had died unexpectedly as a result of a vehicle accident. And they also spend their money on more national causes. So, for example, they send money off to this newspaper called the Fellowship Forum because they're trying to raise money to start a national Ku Klux Klan radio station out of Washington, D.C. And so there's a lot of things that are in the mix, some national, some local, a lot of fundraising efforts. And it creates a very interesting organization because they really had their fingers in a lot of things.
It sounds like they were in many ways a normal fraternal, or I guess in this case, sororal organization, plus xenophobia and anti-Catholic hatred and anti-alcohol advocacy.
Yeah, very fair. In fact, it's really, you know, oftentimes when we think of the 1920s, we focus on the roaring 20s, the jazz age. But there's this reactionary aspect to the 1920s. And there was one historian I read this morning, and I failed to remember his name, but he had said that you can't talk about the 1920s without mentioning the Ku Klux Klan as part of that period. And these women are having fun too, by the way. They're not just howling at the moon in the middle of the night, so to speak. They're having a good time as well, but they are certainly not approving of where the country is going, and they're doing whatever they can to try to stop those changes from happening.
John, I know you're speaking tonight at a book launch event in Chippewa Falls. We'll give those details in just a bit. But what are you hoping people take away from this story?
You know, anything they want to take from it. You know, I'm a historian by nature, so I'm always interested in stories. And of course, whenever you have an opportunity to get records from a secret society, these are not records that come available very often. In fact, this could be the single greatest collection of women's Ku Klux Klan meeting minutes that have ever surfaced. And so to me, it's a matter of just reporting what I found, reporting the information that I have, and then people out there can can do with it as they please.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
John Kinville is a teacher at Chippewa Falls High School. We talked with him about his new book. It's called The Gray Eagles of Chippewa Falls, A Hidden History of a Women's Ku Klux Klan in Wisconsin. As we mentioned, John will be speaking at a book launch event from 6 to 9 o'clock tonight at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. You can also find more about upcoming book talks at his website, johnkinville.com. Quick note that you can hear the 2020 State of the Tribes address tomorrow, streaming at WPR.org. That's tomorrow afternoon at 1. What is the worst smell in the world? I think a lot of people have a smell that really bugs them, but a column in the New York Times tackles the question, is there a smell so bad that it could be universally recognized as the worst in the world? One contender in the column, a smell created by the U.S. military, U.S. government standard bathroom malodor, was created to test cleaning products that could be used in military latrines. Well, I asked around here about smells that people hate. Here's Judith Sears. Poisson, you have some that bug you.
Patchouli.
Patchouli.
I cannot stand it, and I feel like I can smell it from about a football field away.
It is a smell that spreads and
yes.
lingers.
Lingers. It definitely lingers. Yes.
Is it?
I don't know what it is about it, but
is it guilt by association? Did you know someone who used patchouli that bugged
you?
You
know, I feel like there was a time in my life where I was around a lot more patchouli than I am now, but no, there's no, like, it doesn't represent one particular person. I have to say, on the other side of the spectrum, I actually like the smell of skunk.
Yeah.
Diluted. I've never been sprayed.
Right. I was going to say, so I've never been at ground zero yeah. in skunk
but
odor.
But I actually find it pretty pleasant.
Yeah, I don't find it that bad either. Another J. Carlisle Larson said the same.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I like the smell of gasoline too, which some people really don't like, but
that's a little weird. But what's a bad smell to some people is not a bad smell to others.
One pretty universal one is durian. It's a Southeast Asian fruit. It's been likened to eating a strawberry in a toilet.
Wow.
And I tasted and smelled it, and it took literally hours to get out of my head.
Well, by coincidence, Food Friday is cooking with durian.
And I'm hosting.
Oh, no, wait. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.